Hey, GP learners. Over the past few weeks, we've seen a significant rise in the way that patients are using online consultations and how practices are managing that, to the point where many places are saying that the demand is just too much for them to cope with. And this does raise the absolute question of, are GP online consultations actually sustainable in primary care? It's a part that I know many practices have adapted to deal with the pandemic situation. And as we move towards hopefully being out of that, the question is, what's going to happen moving forward? We're going to try and help explain all this to you in this episode, including covering the guidance, including covering our own thoughts, and some additional information that you will hopefully find really useful and your opportunity to join us in terms of your comments and questions. Let's tech enhance your primary care and learning. Hey, GP learners, and welcome to the GP Learning Podcast, where we're going to be talking about online consultations and basically, are they sustainable in general practice? What are you thinking about this topic, Andy?
I think it's a really exciting, interesting, timely topic, and I'm really looking forward to going deep on it. I've got some interesting thoughts for you this morning. Shall we kick off, Gandhi? You've been scanning social media this morning, and I think you've noticed a tweet that sort of relates to this.
Absolutely. So this morning, and this is how live this is. This is literally talking about a couple of hours ago. ITV TV, I think it is in the program this morning, have put out a tweet asking about whether patients are having difficulty getting face-to-face appointments with a view to creating an article about this. And it's already causing a bit of a stir because it's quite leading to a degree in terms of the questions and stuff. And it seems to completely ignore the whole fact that general practice, in terms of its standard operating procedures, in terms of what we're advised to do by NHS England and the contract and everything, basically says that we should be assessing patients first before we offer a face-to-face consultation. And this is for very good reason. Obviously, COVID has been here for the past year or so, and you know, trying to reduce risk of infections to patients, to staff, you know, stopping spread of everything. So that's why there's been this absolute need for having some sort of assessment first before people just come down. And you know, what we would hate to have is a practice becoming a super spreader. Now we're moving out of this, hopefully, and you know, fingers crossed, we're going to see a situation where, you know, COVID is no longer the biggest impact on our daily lives and stuff. But it's a bit of a painful story to read after the year and a half that we've been having. I mean, what do you think, Andy? Because you've only just seen this literally a few minutes ago, haven't you?
Yeah, it's difficult. I'm in two minds about it. So part of me thinks, well, availability of GP appointments, it's always been part of the news cycle. I remember you know, during the pandemic, it's been there, and pre-pandemic, it was always part of the news cycle. And it was always quite demoralizing for GPs, not only GPs actually, but our reception staff and other staff in the practice would often talk about these sort of articles when they came into work and actually find it quite demoralizing because everybody in the practice works hard to try and optimize the amount of access that we're able to provide our patients to healthcare. So I find the sort of articles demoralizing. Also, in a way, you know, it's healthy for a free media to ask these questions and prompt these debates, I suppose. But then they've got a responsibility to represent the facts honestly. And I think that's sometimes where they fall down, I guess. I'll be interested to see where they go with this one. Hopefully they give right to reply to some of our GP representatives from RCGP and GPC group, who often do a good job at going out to bat for us, I think, on these topics. So it'd be interesting to see how it develops.
We're hoping that we do see a proactive response from our representative organisations on this particular part, particularly since, and to emphasise this again, the standing operating procedures for general practice right now is that all face-to-face contacts should have some form of contact beforehand to make sure it's safe and appropriate for both the patient and for the practice staff as well. But part of that contact may be through online consultations, which is obviously the focus of this episode. And just before we started talking in more detail about that, we did want to have one slight declaration and stuff. Obviously, we're talking about our opinions and thoughts on this particular matter, although we're talking about some of the guidance as well for general practitioners and practices and stuff. To be clear, we are not the authority on this particular area, although we've got some experience, haven't we, Andy?
We do, yeah. I mean, we read and we apply this guidance in our roles on a daily basis. However, if you're in a similar position in applying these and you only apply what we say and not the correct interpretation of the guidance, don't come for us when the CCG won't release funds to you. You're responsible for reading the guidance yourself. But hopefully we can give people a guide and give people, you know, our opinions and the opinions of other people on it, which I think is, and stoke some discussion, which I think is really, really useful and makes the job and life a bit more interesting.
Yeah. We're going to start off by talking about the definition of the online consultations and stuff. So, you know, what exactly is an online consultation? So I'm going to ask you, Andy, what do you think is an online consultation?
So, well, I know in preparation for this, we were looking at the core digital offer, which defines it. So it's difficult because I've read that now. But I think when most people hear online consultation, I think they'll think about an interaction with a clinician that takes place not in person and not on the telephone. I think that's probably what most people would understand as an online consultation. So something that is like a normal consultation, so maybe something that you book or that you kind of initiate or seek as a patient, mm-hmm. Or consent to being seen, like a checkup. You know, if the practice might contact you and ask to start it, but it's something that is arranged and that takes place in cyberspace. I guess that's what I think most people would understand. How close to that is it? Is the definition? Yeah.
Not bad. So clearly it's through a route that is a digital route. And there's various different mechanisms that people can use that. But one of the key things that I think that we need to recognize is that the definition does include the fact that it needs to be patient generated. So not just the practice being able to deliver digital consultations. So things like a video consultation, for example, that would be a digital consultation, but it wouldn't be an online one. And telephone, same thing. But it has to be patient initiated. And I do have a slight apology to give to a lot of the EGP learners and stuff on this particular part. So for a while, my interpretation of that had been that also that would include that from a contractual perspective, you're just doing things like the photo consultations or sending documents and stuff that would fulfill the criteria of what an online consultation is. It doesn't. So after reviewing the guidance, that doesn't satisfy the criteria. It does have to be patient initiated. And that could be through your website, that could be through a practice app, that could be through the NHS app, which is, I know, what a lot of the organizations that we're going to be talking about in a while have been striving to achieve. So they integrate clearly with the NHS app, and particularly with things like the vaccine passport side of things being integrated with the NHS app. And, you know, so many more things now starting to look like it's going to be working with that, you know, that I think is a really positive thing. But the key part is also it has to be patient initiated, and practices do have to provide this. It is in their contract to provide online consultations.
However, I would say there's a little bit of a disclaimer for the moment, isn't there, just at the bottom of the core digital offer description. Or is it in a different? Here we go. Yeah. So currently, if practices are operating a total triage system, which I think most practices have been operating throughout the pandemic and continue to, then actually you don't need to meet the 25% online booking contract requirement at the moment.
Yeah,
that's my understanding.
We're getting slightly confused again though. So we were talking earlier about online consultations. That particular is talking about online appointment bookings.
Booking.
Okay. So part of the contract originally stated that 25% of general practitioners' appointments, so the practice itself, not just the GPs, but the nurses or the other healthcare staff that work within it, have to be available to be booked online. Because of everything that happened with COVID and because of the shift towards total triage, there is a rider with that. If you are focused on total triage, whether that's telephone, online consultations, that kind of stuff, then that 25% is not applicable. So, you know, if you are moving towards a face-to-face model as your only way of doing things, then you are required to provide 25% of your appointments as an online bookable. Okay. If you're doing total triage, you don't. For now, they may change that again. But that's the kind of proviso they made to help support, you know, total triage in the pandemic element and stuff and things.
So this is the description of the core digital offer, which talks through, I suppose, not just online consultations, because it talks through some of the other modes of communicating with patients online that might not actually qualify as an online consultation, like the ability to hold video consultations and so forth. But it's a pretty good description of what practices should be aiming to do currently, would you say, Gandhi, in terms of their online offer? Should we just go through? I think we're doing most of these in practice. Mm-hmm. I think we're even, it might be just worth, I'm curious, Gandhi, to know what you're doing in practice sort of on each of these and how you're addressing them. So it might be worth just quickly going through just to give people an idea really as well of how to implement things. So now we're, in terms of the first one, we're beginning to use AirMid actually, to allow patients to use the AirMid app or sort of System One online web portal to ask us questions using a very simple structured information gathering questionnaire, which then sort of pops into our kind of task ecosystem within within System One and gets booked in as an appointment. So that's what we're doing. I know a lot of people have gone for much more complex solutions and more comprehensive solutions using different providers. What are you doing, Gandhi, at the moment with that?
So similar, we're looking at using PKB, which is a platform provider for us in the Nottinghamshire area. Like you say, AirMid is the System One integrated version. There's loads of other ones out there. So Primary Care IT do their One Contact platform when you talk about web-based form kind of stuff. And then, as you mentioned, there's lots and lots and lots of other providers out there as well. We'll come to those in a second, though. But yeah, lots of different routes that can happen. That is the key thrust, I think, of a lot of this guidance, that you have to have that mechanism. Now, are the CCGs and NHS England going to start coming around and knocking on your door saying, are you doing this? You know, what are you doing? How much are you doing? Not just yet, but I think once the GP appointment work that many practices are doing, which we created a video on just a week or so ago to help practices understand how to do that, once that information starts coming through, I think maybe there will be. So important to note, this is something that if you aren't already providing it, you kind of need to get your skates on and start doing at least something. And what that something is, we'll talk about in a second. The next part talks about video consultations. I think most practices have had a mechanism for providing video consultations, but recognizing that this may not be the, you know, the panacea that everyone thought it was going to be. Although it has been very useful, obviously, when there's a pandemic going around at times and stuff. I don't know what your experiences have been with video, particularly more recently, rather than...
Yeah, been mixed. Still a limited use case scenario, I think. Can sometimes, in those kind of borderline... It's good for making a decision when you're on the borderline of whether you need to see someone face-to-face or not. Yeah. I think, broadly speaking, is when they are most useful, I think. So at that point in the telephone consultation where you think, do I need to see this child or not, might eyeballing this child and seeing if they're jumping up and down and running around the room avert a consultation, that sort of thing, that's when I think that they're quite useful. So I think they've still got their place, I think. Two-way secure written communication. I suppose you're probably beginning with implementations of PKB, I suppose, Gandhi. Is that your solution at the moment?
Or? Yeah, and like you say, this is two-way, isn't it? So this is a patient being able to give information to a practice, and that can be useful in various different ways, and it can also be challenging in different ways. There is also the opportunity for practices to send information to patients, which actually I think many practices have found this to be a really effective way of delivering healthcare. So, you know, the opportunity to send photos back and forth between clinicians, I think, has been a game changer. Having, you know, that done en masse, I think, has helped a lot. And also documents, so things like Med3 fit notes, phlebotomy forms, sometimes leaflets and that kind of stuff as well, you know, information sharing aspects. I think very few places would find that hasn't been a useful tool for that particular part.
No, it's been really, really useful. And I think we've been using AccuRx largely for some of the functions you've described, but I think there's now an increasing amount of choice actually in terms of the systems that work well, and it's nice to see System One and AirMid providing some solutions which are sort of directly from the clinical system as well. Up-to-date accessible online presence. So I think practice website largely serves that purpose for a lot of people. That's fairly simple to meet, I guess. And then symptom checkers. Again, these are often integrated within the online appointment systems that people might be using. And it's fairly easy, actually, even to sort of place us the NHS.uk symptom checker you know, on your practice website. I think most of the website providers do that. Or if you're doing your website in-house, then you can sort of place that in or around the place where people book appointments or link through to book their appointments online. And that can serve that purpose. Anything else to say on that, Gandhi?
No, I think you're right. The website is absolutely, I think, the focus many practices need to use. Having those opportunities like your online consultation provider robust and, you know, big and everything on the website is useful if that's how you're planning on using it. It's interesting that some patients have real hesitations for using apps, whereas they will be happier to use a web portal, and vice versa as well. You know, I think the concept when a lot of these systems allow us to do two-way communication a lot more effectively, so we can send notifications to patients on their phone, on their app about their healthcare system, that has real benefit, particularly in monitoring chronic disease in particular. So, you know, if you've got a patient with diabetes, being able to send them a simple reminder on their phone through their app saying that actually you're due your medication review, or you need to have your blood test before your medication review, or, you know, those are various different aspects. I think that that's something that would be really appreciative for that to work a lot more effectively. But having the access is absolutely important. The symptom checker, like you say, NHS app does provide that as a really basic form. Some of the providers do have much more integrated and in-depth versions, and the question of how the logic and stuff for those work, you know, that's a question for each provider in terms of how effective they are. We're going to come to that when we talk about online consultation providers a bit more detail.
Gandhi, I was just going to come back to the practice website and app. Mm-hmm. Question as well, actually, because I think it's a bit like when people underestimated the text message, and then, you know, actually text messages actually have been really, really useful over the course of the last year. And, you know, so is the telephone. You know, we're using a lot more of the telephone, and I think sometimes these slightly older technologies don't always go away and are replaced by newer ones. Mm-hmm. I know our practice website gets a lot of traffic. I think a lot of people, just in terms of how they book an appointment, they could bookmark the link to go straight to System One online, but they don't. What they'll do is they'll type the name of the practice into Google, they'll go to the practice website, and they'll use our link. And I don't think people change those sorts of behaviors really easily. No. I think also people quite like websites because they just have one browser app on their phone. They don't have to worry about which app their GP surgery wants them to use this year to access, you know, online consultations, and they might switch to a different provider next year. You know, there's something about the permanence of the practice website that I think people should think about, and actually, you know, linking activity through the website is a good way to anchor something in the patient's consciousness, and then you can bolt other things in and out of that patient flow. You know, once they've landed on the website, you can direct them to all sorts of different places and apps. So just wanted to highlight that, really. And I think websites probably have a place, you know, in that system going forwards, rather than lots and lots of different apps, which I think would frustrate me as a patient and probably frustrates other patients.
Agree. I think the NHS app itself could be the alternative doorway. And, you know, like I said, having system providers sit behind that, so it's a seamless integration, so patients don't really even recognize which platform they're then on. And like you say, they're not having to have different apps for different practices and all that kind of stuff. That would be probably a really nice way in directing patients through care for that. That definitely speaks into the next topic, which is about shared access and information to the notes, which obviously the NHS app does provide if your practice has switched it on. Massive implication with vaccine passports, because that's now how patients are going to be able to access their vaccination information for COVID vaccines in particular. Will be through the NHS app, as long as your practice is switched on the process. And that's something that's going to be fun to deal with over the next few months, because I'm sure that's going to be completely unfunded and unsupported workload that has now been transferred to general practice. Yay!
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, actually, actually, if you're engaging with the NHS app, then that really looks after those last three points for you, provided you activate the relevant things and play ball with the NHS app, then you'll be hitting those last few points. So that's good. So I think these things are achievable, actually, with a little bit of thought within your average practice. And I think the tools are there to do it now at low or zero cost. If you take a rough and ready approach and use things like System One's AirMID, for example, which is currently free. But if you want to get a little bit more, put a little more in and maybe get a little bit more value out in terms of the impact on your practice workflow, for your staff and potentially the patients, then there are a lot of paid for options that can do a lot more, I think. So it's a very interesting ecosystem.
There is, and it's probably a good point to talk about the various different providers that are out there. So as you mentioned, there's obviously the electronic health record provider, so System One, EMIS, that kind of stuff. Interesting, EMIS hasn't really gone into delivering online consultations in such great detail, whereas System One, particularly over the past year, has invested a lot more time and you know, look into how that works from the user perspective. Obviously, Slight Decoration, you and I work with System One on doing various things, including our upcoming System One Facebook Users Group conference, which is on the 30th of June. For those that are planning on attending, we'll be sending out details about that shortly. But, you know, loads of other providers out there that act as kind of like a bolt-on for practice to use with their patients to provide online consultations. So if people are interested, we've created loads of videos about how these kind of different providers work, from, you know, people like, so looking at that one. So we've got Clinic, Engage Consult, Accurix, Ask My GP, eConsult. There's loads of others out there as well. Loads of other companies that provide more simpler versions, like form-based interactions. So Arden's, Primary Care IT, MedLink, there's loads of them, to be honest, absolutely loads. So yeah, if people are interested, we'll put some links down to those particular episodes and stuff that you can have a look at and things. But they all provide something different. They are now provided for in most areas by the CCG, and which one you have is variable in terms of access and stuff. And obviously how they work is also variable as well. So some people say that, you know, one is worse than the other in terms of how the information flows, one's better than the other. I think there's definitely a user element, and there's also both from the clinicians as well from the patients in terms of how effective these can be. I mean, what are your thoughts, Andy, on this particular part?
Well, so two thoughts. So before we move to sustainability, actually, I was just wondering about what your thoughts are on the state of the kind of business ecosystem around online consultations, because there's an awful lot of providers at the moment. They all provide something slightly different. Mm-hmm. They differentiate themselves from one another and from the larger providers in all sorts of unique ways. I think there's a lot of innovation in this space. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you think there will there always be space for this many providers, or are we going to see a consolidation down to a smaller number? What do you think is going to happen to all of these companies, Gandhi, and in this space?
We talked about this when we did our episode about how to purchase your digital healthcare system. I don't know if you remember. And yeah, it was very much, I think we are going to see some consolidation of these providers, I think, because they'll integrate to provide either additional resources or you know, better offers and that kind of thing. And we've seen that, for example, with like MJOG and Livy, you know, in terms of how they work together. I think eConsult works collaboratively with several other organizations to provide additional bolt-ons and stuff for their, you know, kind of thing. I think the game changer will be if any of these providers directly integrates and you know, works with the electronic healthcare system providers, so System One and EMIS, that would be a massive thing in terms of the change of the landscape of healthcare. Yeah, I think they're going to be the interesting part is how the purchasing works. And we talked about that in that episode, that the user is the practices, but the purchaser is the CCGs. And that's the complexity, because it comes down to then cost versus actual usability. And it's different people having different things on their mind when they're making that decision. So,
yeah, I think the health systems need to be really good at procuring these sorts of systems. Actually, it's mm-hmm. actually really, really complicated, isn't it, to get something that ticks the CCG boxes, but then also people are willing to adopt and push and put their discretionary effort into making work at the practice level. It's really interesting. I think we've probably got an episode lined up about how to do that effectively, or we should do, mm-hmm. Because I think doing that well is a real challenge. So anyway, yeah, I was just thinking about the state of the ecosystem, because I think it's really, really interesting to see what's going to happen going forward. I suppose the other thing as well is that, you know, the larger players can often borrow, integrate, not steal, but kind of innovate around the sorts of things that the smaller players are doing, you know, at low cost, where those ideas aren't necessarily protected as intellectual mm-hmm. property in any way, and start to integrate things. So I've noticed a lot of System One are bringing on, in particular, a lot of features that have been seen in some of the smaller mm-hmm. providers and just integrating them directly. So I think that will have be interesting to see the effect on the smaller providers. Really interesting space. But the big question at the start of this video was, is this sustainable, the use of online consultations. So
it'd be a good time to look at some of the comments we've already had. So thank you to everybody that you know has been putting in some of these comments, and you know, this is the reason why we kind of brought up this topic. So you know, Jay Shpuri is, well, I think online consultations are a useful tool. The issue is the unlimited nature of this, which we don't have capacity for. I mean, I think that sums up the past few weeks for many working in general practice, and I'm sure even patients have noticed this in terms of the impact it's having in their healthcare, in terms of access for appointments, how quickly they're getting replies back from practices. Demand has just literally doubled, and you know, we've even done the evidence for this. We have seen a double in the number of contacts we've had from patients in April compared to the previous 3 months, and if you compare that to this time 18 months ago. So, you know, we're talking about January 2020. So that's pre-pandemic. We're significantly above what we were seeing then. And that was obviously winter time, you know, when you'd expect to be really busy and chaotic and stuff. So it's challenging.
What are you seeing on the ground, Gandhi? I think we're seeing a lot of people catching up with their healthcare to a certain extent, things that they've left for a long time, that they're just kind of deciding, okay, now's the time. You know, lockdown is easing. Now is the time to start catching up with a lot of these symptoms and things that I've been ignoring for a while. And that comes on top of the existing kind of newly developing demand that happens all the time. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think there's multiple reasons why demand has jumped up significantly. So I think number one, like you say, is there are definitely going to be lots of patients out there that have held fire in terms of a lot of their health concerns and issues. And now that things have started to open up, they feel that, you know, now is the time to come and talk to us about it. So that there's absolutely that part. There's the backlog, you know, because everything, you know, paused and stopped for a while in terms of the way that routine healthcare worked, and we went down to emergency only, obviously, for a significant portion of 2020. Then, you know, there is the capacity of secondary care and other services to help out and look at, you know, what they're doing. And then that's causing a backlog in terms of patient care from general practice and repeat attendance. You know, the past week I spoke to a patient 3 times in the week about a health issue that, with all due respect, I've got to the limit of what I can do for them. You know, what they need now is further investigations from secondary care that I can't provide for them. Unfortunately, they're not having that contact for at least another 2 months, but they're struggling. And I don't know what to do and how to help them further, because I literally have done everything I can think of. And, you know, the practice has done everything that we can think of, but we are at that limit. And quite rightly, the patient's concerned, because they're like, well, what do I do? I'm still suffering. I'm like,
No, it's true. I think, yeah, we're seeing a lot of patients bouncing off secondary care still, or seeing long waits for secondary care interventions, which means in the meantime, they continue to consult their GP when ordinarily they'd be sorted and you know, no longer consulting their GP because they'd be in the secondary care system.
It's not just secondary care as well. We're talking a lot about the third party services that, you know, used to provide support, particularly for, you know, mental health parts in particular. But, you know, podiatry services just seem to be non-existent in some places. You know, there's various different parts that are clearly not working as well as they used to, for whatever reason that may be. And that has an impact in terms of patient needs and stuff. And then I think, generally, the expectation has changed. Online consultations makes the route of access different. People will talk about it being better. So people talk about it being easier, quicker, all these lovely kind of adjectives and stuff. I just say it's different. And I think there are some people where it can work really well. I think there are absolutely some people where it will not work at all. And it's probably the worst thing that they could have engaged with, because it's just going to make the process more anxious, angst, and that kind of stuff. And you can definitely see that again in some of the comments. So Ali saying that online booking is a terrible thing. Yeah, definitely understand that point of view. You know, various other challenges that we've had in terms of what people are saying.
Is anyone having a positive experience of online consultations, or, you know, on e-consultations, online booking? Because we're getting sort of mostly negative comments actually coming through about the process itself, as you've just highlighted, or just about the ecosystem of providers being complicated, CCGs selecting products and services which individual practices don't use, or where individual practices have already committed to using an alternative, all sorts of problematic implementation.
So far, we haven't got anything in the chat that reflects that. But I think, you know, if people have had a positive experience, I'd like to hear about it. I've had a couple, you know. So we mentioned earlier about things like documentation sending. So photos, med3s, phlebotomy, all that kind of stuff, prescription codes, that kind of stuff. Being able to send those in a two-way method, I think worked really, really well and absolutely a benefit to general practice. I think in terms of non-urgent stuff, you know, trying to understand, you know, particularly administrative functions, you know, prescription requests, you know, wanting to deal with documentation, letters, all that kind of stuff that don't need a physical appointment. It's just either a discussion or a sharing of information, you know, updating us on the patient's blood pressure, particularly if they're doing it at home. You know, do I need an appointment just for a patient to give me their blood pressure readings? No, that's not the best use of my time. That's not the best use of their time, taking time out of their day just to come to the practice to give me some readings about their blood pressure. And for me to say, yes, that's okay, and we don't do anything different. No, that's not okay. And how do we move that forward? Well, here's our options. You tell me which one you want to go with, and then we'll work out whether or not we need to have a discussion about those or whether you're okay for me to just do those or not, you know?
Gandhi, I think just a thought here, because I think when we're talking about online consultations, it's almost too broad a brush, I think, because there's two sides to this coin. There are technologies, most of the ones you were describing as positive are technologies which improve clinician efficiency and save time for the clinician and are clinician driven and, you know, benefit the system and benefit patients because they actually make things easier, safer, and less time consuming for the physician to do. And that's where you're describing the positive experiences. And that's all physicians led and physicians initiated. And that was actually largely how ultimately video consultations, for example, ended up being implemented during the pandemic. Was actually they ended up being a physician choice to do it. And then they were viewed as positive and probably had a positive impact. The other side of the coin is patient sort of convenience and ease of access. And I think that's where there's a lot more danger lies because that's where you can create new patient behaviors, lower the threshold for seeking health care advice and drive volume and demand. And we often consider them as the same thing, but I just wonder if it might be beneficial for us and the system to start thinking about these technologies a little bit more separately because they have different effects on the system. Anyway, just a thought.
Okay. I mean, there's definitely some comments that fit with that. So, it's gone. Got an extra one there. Jayesh again, so Accurics texting helped us to let patients know the results, but then again, this adds to our unseen work as they may previously have been a phone call, you know, in terms of the additional stuff that we're doing. I think it's not just clinicians, it's absolutely patients' perception as well. So again, you know, I've had a patient who said that, that they wrote a complaint against our practice saying that, you know, that they've not had an appointment at the practice in the past 6 months. Well, they have. So that patient has had at least 15 telephone consultations, two video consultations, and they've actually had one face-to-face consultation as well. But their perception is that they've not had any contact at all with the practice because they've only had that limited contact in terms of the face-to-face thing. And it's that perception, I think, that from the public also needs to be, to be honest, changed, that general practice is now different. You know, just walking into your practice and having a face-to-face consultation for every single contact is not what general practice is going to be. That we are told not to do that, in fact. And emphasis, this comes back to our earlier point from the, you know, this morning tweet. The contract, actually, our standard operation procedures now state we should not be doing that. And that message needs to be continued to be shared with patients because it is likely this is going to continue. It will definitely be different, I think, post-pandemic. We will absolutely be seeing more patients face-to-face because we need to. Once the infection control things change. But does that mean that a face-to-face contact is the first point of contact for absolutely everything? Personally, I would say no. That's my personal view. But I appreciate others will have a different view on that. What do you think, Andy?
I'd agree with you. I'd agree. We're talking about sustainability here. So I think in order to talk about sustainability, I think we sort of have to say what actually does sustainable online consultations look like? Mm-hmm. And for me, there are a few broad areas that I think need to satisfy. Not all of them, but I think that we have to reach an understanding that they are effective in some way, that they actually deliver something more than what we had before. I think we've got to understand that they're safe. They have to be clinically, you know, demonstrated to be clinically not less safe than face-to-face consultations, or that at least we can manage that risk effectively. I think there's an efficiency, time and resources question. We've got to either demonstrate that they allow us to actually do more with less, or if that's not the case, but there's a demand from the system for them, then more resources need to go in. So I think we need to understand that efficiency question better. And then I think if the intention is to improve access and the patient experience, then we have to actually demonstrate that it does that. I mean, look at what's happening on ITV this morning. It looks like people are complaining about the patient experience of having theoretically increased online telephone access to their GPs as opposed to face-to-face. You know, if nobody wants it, then it has to be really good in these other areas of efficiency and safety and effectiveness, or you know, why are we doing it? And then I think there's the element of the effect on working lives of clinicians. And in order to be sustainable, people have to be able to do this work and manage the volumes of work that are created. And they have to be able to manage the stress of managing risk in patients that they can't see, often can't, definitely can't touch, often can't even hear their voice, but are responsible for that patient's sort of safety and risk. So they have to understand that. So that's how I define sustainable. It's got to be pretty damn good at a number of those. I think we can go deeper in some of those areas, but those are my broad thoughts. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what you said then. I think, you know, when we talk about efficiency or managing things differently, you know, we mentioned earlier that there are some things I think very well lend itself to online consultations. So the administrative stuff in particular, and, you know, being able to separate that out from the clinical workload means that different parts of your team can deal with that more effectively. And that team could be, for example, admin staff in practice to deal with, like we said, letters, you know, your prescription team, whether that's prescription clerks, pharmacists, that kind of stuff, to deal with prescription queries, you know, only that are coming through. Mm. So that's what, you know, sometimes some of our consultations are just simply a prescription query. Or, you know, some of the more simpler things that can be dealt with by, you know, staff like clinician associates, nurses, you know, that are geared towards their particular clinical areas. So, you know, chronic disease management, contraception, you know, minor illness, all those kind of things. So using our workforce more effectively, whether that's in person in the practice, but also remotely, because don't forget, because of the pandemic, we have seen the opportunity for us to be able to, for the clinicians to work remotely. And say, for example, if you have a clinician that has to be somewhere else because of, for example, childcare or isolation or something else, they can still continue to function and support the practice. They may not be able to do everything they were doing before, so they won't be able to physically put a hand onto a patient, but they could, for example, do the clinical admin, they could deal with online consultations for the practice, and then, you know, have those managed in a way that is effective for the practice. It builds a bit more resilience. Okay, resilience is the wrong word. Hated that word. Apologies to everybody that I just used that word in this context because it's the wrong word to use. What's the word I'm looking at? Business continuity. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, resilience often means putting up with more bad conditions, doesn't it?
This is not resilience, this is business continuity and things. So, yeah. I guess the other part, though, that's been really interesting is the timeliness that all this stuff comes through. So one of the things about, obviously, online consultations, it's 24/7 or has the opportunity to be 24/7. And this brings in absolute challenge. And I think this is where a lot of practices are really, really struggling in the past 4 weeks in particular. So, you know, I'm hearing of some practices that have said that they have had, you know, 400, 800 online, you know, consultation requests in a week coming through, which is a significant amount. You know, there's always this old adage, you will never see more than 10% of your practice population in a week. Now, our practices were doing that well before the pandemic anyway. But I know there are many practices that are seeing significant demand above even that level. And, you know, those kind of volumes raises the question of you still have to sift through them because you have to figure out which are the ones that are clinically urgent and which are the ones that are not clinically urgent and things. And then how do you deal with those? And that's where I think many people are really struggling. So, you know, the answer many people are talking about is switching off the online consultations at points in the day. So it's not available 24/7. I kind of think that might be counterproductive because the whole point of it allows the workload to come at a time that then is potentially manageable. I'm not going to say it's manageable, but potentially manageable. Whereas when you switch it off, you're still creating that whole 8 o'clock in the morning phone lines are open situation.
I've got an opinion about access, which might be a little bit controversial, but it's just kind of stripping it down really to the economics behind you know, the behavioral economics behind patient behavior, of which I'm not an expert, but you know, I am an observer, and I think where something is free and has no monetary cost, then there's there's an incentive to use it more because there's no disincentive to use it inappropriately. So there's an incentive to use it more, and I think you get more inappropriate use. That's why, you know, in the past people have spoken about applying a charge for a GP appointment. Mm-hmm. You know, those were the sorts of debates that we were having around controlling demand pre-pandemic. Because it limits inappropriate use. That means there's more time to spend on the appropriate cases that come through. So actually there can be a beneficial effect on mm-hmm. on health. And then if you actually say, not only is it free, but you don't even have to wait on the telephone for the phone to ring several times. You don't even have to wait for the GP surgery to open. There's not even a time cost. Then I just think that's going to further reduce the quality of the cases that come through. And I know when we've engaged in pilot schemes to reduce barriers to accessing appointments at the practice in the past, a few years ago, the quality of some of the cases that would come through was really quite poor. And by that, I mean, you might have fit, healthy people, you know, in their 20s with no other medical conditions who've had a cough for 3 hours ringing and expecting to have contact with general practice. And I just worry that if we have access to general practice opinion that is free, that you can have any time, day or night, that you will just drive that sort of demand, and you won't have time to deal with and see the patients who actually need help. I'm worried about this. And I'm also worried about the direction the debate's gone, because now we're talking about, you know, we're seriously talking about putting these sorts of systems in place. Free, unlimited demand. All you have to do is pick up your phone. When actually a few years ago, we were talking about applying charges, you know, mm-hmm. to things, you know. And just one final thing at the end of this rant from personal experience, you know, I very rarely call my GP. I won't say who the GP surgery are, but you ring in the morning. Sometimes you get an appointment. Sometimes you don't. You know, the appointment is that. So you ring in the morning. They have a morning session, and they will, if you ring and there's a telephone slot still available in the morning, they'll call you back at some point that morning and speak mm-hmm. to you. But if all the appointments are gone, I say, no, all the appointments are gone. Ring back in the afternoon at 12 o'clock, and then you can get an afternoon appointment. And then if they're all gone, they say, ring back in the morning. You know what happened? I rang, I thought I was unwell. By the time we got to lunchtime, I was feeling better. And, you know, I didn't call them back, and I was absolutely fine. But if I wasn't fine, I'd have rang them. It just made me wait a little bit longer. And that was actually the right thing for my health. And if it wasn't, I'd have still rang them. So it was safe. So I actually think systems that have designed into them a small amount of time or monetary, but even time cost for patients can actually be pretty, you know, it can actually be pretty effective. You know, that's a tool. We shouldn't worry about that being a tool, you know, watchful waiting or masterly, what is it? There's a term, masterly doing nothing anyway is a tactic that you can use. Sorry, Gandhi, rant over.
I agree with everything you just said. So no, definitely not a rant. And I think it's one of the things that unfortunately online consultations drives us away from. It's that element of patient self-care, patient-directed self-care, shall we say, because it offers the opportunity for you to send self-care information to a patient, and you can obviously have AI triage and all that kind of stuff helping to support it.
You got to put someone in the loop. That's the thing. I know you're about to say that, but safety, generally, you need a human in the loop. So it takes time and resources.
Yeah, but it takes away from that whole. So I think Ali's put the comment that you were looking for. I'm going to bring it on screen so I get my mouse there. Masterly inactivity.
That's it. Perfect.
But it's true. Watchful waiting is an absolute core skill that GPs, above all other types of clinicians, understand, because we recognize that the majority of health issues on their own will get better. A viral illness is an excellent example of that. So I'm not talking about COVID, but majority of viral infections, for the majority of people, will get better with due time. So, you know, your simple ERTs, your coughs, your sore throats, those kind of things. But we've moved towards a health state where people don't want to accept that that's what they have to deal with, you know, that it takes a bit of time for your body to sort things out, and that, yes, there are things you could try to manage the symptoms, so pain relief, you know, cough expectorants, you know, antidiarrheals, that kind of stuff if you've got loose stools and things. But actually, it's giving your body time to do what it can do really, really well, which is fix itself, because our human bodies are amazing at doing that, you know. But we've got to a state where many people don't feel that's acceptable, because of the busyness of life, you know, the concept I like to call the immediacy of treatment. They want it gone now so that they can continue doing what they're meant to be doing, whether that's for work, whether that's for home life, whether that's sustainability of their own kind of, you know, life state and things. That's health. You know, don't get me wrong, there are absolutely times where people need contact, and completely understand where understanding the difference between what is, you know, a simple viral infection versus something obviously more complex and needing support and health. That can be a hard thing for somebody who is not medically trained to completely understand in its entirety. But that doesn't discount the fact that common things are common. But we also do need to recognize that rare things do happen.
Yeah. I was getting some support from my rant there. That was nice in the comments. Okay, so spot on, Andy, says Jayesh Puri. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to patient education, because this is where I think the focus needs to move towards. So we've talked about obviously a lot of the challenges that many places are facing, the significant demand that many of us are facing. How can we turn this around? Okay, how can we make this more effective? So absolutely one, I would say, is patient education. So understanding, A, what is an online consultation, what it should be used for, and the best way to doing that in your practice. We're going to share this. So it's something that came out from a practice. It's public information, so you're welcome to access it. And this was their version of trying to help patients understand what an online consultation is. So they use a platform called eConsult to do it. If you want to have a look at it, the links are down below in the description and stuff, so you can access it and things. It's lengthy. I'd say it's a little direct, probably. I know, Andy, you haven't actually read this yet, have you?
No. So, Gandhi, summarize it to me. What approach are they taking?
It basically identifies some of the challenges with online consultations. I think particularly the challenges the practice has probably been feeling and facing over the past few weeks. It potentially is a little blamey, depending on your perspective of how you want to take it, and whether it's saying that patients are using them incorrectly. I think there's probably both to the way that this has gone. I think it definitely identifies some of the challenges the practices are facing. Does it help to direct how the patients can manage things a bit more effectively? Yes, it does have that content in there. But when you look at it, that part that you've zeroed in on, I think there's two different ways of looking at it. I think many clinicians will look at that and think, yes, that says exactly what I want to say. But it's important to recognize that patients haven't really had a lot of training and time and experience to deliver online consultations, because it's a fairly new thing. You know, general practice wise, on mass use, it's been a year, which is not a long time, to be honest. But patients using it, you know, Have we actually spent any time explaining to patients how to use it? We've just kind of expected them to do it. You know, we're saying to patients, instead of accessing us in the way that you normally used to, whether it was by telephone or face-to-face, we now want you to use an online consultation method where you write down everything and send it to us through that route. And that's it. And we're expecting them to understand how to do that effectively every single time. And that may be why we have some patients that can't use that system effectively. And then we may have some patients where they're using it so much that it's becoming that in itself a challenge. So, you know, having patients that contact you 7 times a day for an online consultation, you know, that's not effective mm-hmm. for both parts of the, you know, both sides of, the, you know, the coin and things. So I think we need to move towards onboarding patients, to be honest, to understand how to use these systems. Lots of patient education, how to do it more effectively, not just in the practicalities, but also when to use it. And I think this website tries to do some of that. It maybe the tone is possibly just needs consideration a bit more personally, but
onboarding. It's a good concept. I know we've spoken about it before actually, but just onboarding patients properly to how to use your services as a GP surgery is probably a pretty good idea. And I remember just as a simple thing, and this might be onboarding at its most basic, but when we did new baby checks a few years ago as part of that process, and it was prompted by the availability of a really, really good booklet about self-care or looking after your baby yourself in terms of simple things that you can fix or monitor yourself. We used to have a really good booklet and we had tons of them provided for free. You probably had them as well, Gandhi. Mm. And that made us all, as part of doing our baby check, our 6-week postnatal, we had a little bit of a spiel about, going forwards, you know, we're here if needed, if you've got concerns, but as the health visitor who is there for some of those smaller things like X, Y, and Z, and there's a lot you can do yourself, and here's some information for you. And I never really measured the effectiveness of that, but I always thought that was quite good. And, it's onboarding and it's very basic, isn't it? Onboarding those new patients that join us at 6 weeks, 6 weeks old, and explaining to their parents how to use the service effectively. But maybe there's a role for doing a lot more of that, I think, setting people's expectations.
And potentially providing the different routes as well. So you talked about having a booklet. Well, what about having a podcast, for example? Mm-hmm. You know, what about having a video that shows patients how to use the practice effectively, shows them the different types of consultations you offer them? You know, I think there's so many different ways that this could be looked at to help educate patients how to use their practice more effectively. So then they're not just hitting, you know, these blocks every single time and getting frustrated and then getting angry, and then it just builds and it creates more tension, more frustration, and that's where you have more angst. And I wonder if this was written with a bit of angst behind it. I can definitely see myself having been in a situation where I would love to have, you know,
this is the sort of thing you would write, Gandhi. You, in a way, it's
I hope
you don't mind me saying that, but you see things clearly, and this person sees things clearly and has expressed it, or not necessarily for the patient audience, but it's, you know, it's the sort of list.
And again, so Jayesh is putting out some amazing bangers out there. So we spent years teaching our patients to self-care, but I feel e-consults has undone it with how easy it is to get advice from the GP. And I think that's part of the challenge. So, you know, many people have now gone from the instant access to the GP. Well, don't make it be the GP that deals with it, you know, to a degree. Have somebody else that's clinically trained to filter some of this stuff for you. So that's where the other roles come into play in terms of, you know, the other support and things that you may want to consider. You know, PCN staff, both you and I are PCN clinical directors, so this was inevitably going to come up. But, you know, we have additional roles to help us with some of this stuff. So why not use those additional roles to help manage the acute online consultation demand? Is there the opportunity of using things like the OD funding that primary care networks have to create hubs that can help practices manage their online consultation flow, for example? Is there the opportunity of using the additional role staff to help us manage that? The physician's associates, personally, I think would be an excellent role with a bit of training that can help to deal with some of these. You know, the pharmacy technicians, pharmacists, dealing with prescription queries, you know, so many of the additional roles I think could support the way that practices manage the both acute and chronic demand that comes through an online consultation to making sure it gets to the right person. They may not be able to complete it, but at least filtering and picking out the parts that are relevant and helping to deal with that. Absolutely.
I think they can help, but I think we've just got to be careful that what they're dealing with actually needs to be dealt with, and that isn't a purely, you know, sort of self-care issue. I think the systems need to be better. I'll just put that out there. I think the whole promise of these systems is that they can deal with certain queries within the system, and, you know, and an exit route for some queries can be genuinely patient, you can watch and wait, or you can, you know, here's some self-care information so that you can manage yourself safely. I'm not sure the systems are able to do that yet. I think they need to probably be a little bit more sophisticated, and there's some technical development, and there's probably some risk management development, which is more complicated, with elements of that being technical and elements of that being legal you know, experience based, you know, in terms of just running with these systems. So I think if they can reach that level of maturity where they can genuinely do that, then I think they're genuinely useful. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that we're there yet, but hopefully we'll get there. Gandhi, I've got a question for you. I've been a bit negative about the development of online consultations. A lot of the people in the chat have. You've obviously got, you know, some reservations yourself as well. If you could just put all of this back in Pandora's box and go back to ring in the morning, get a face-to-face appointment. If you can't, then ring in the afternoon. If you can't, ring next morning. If you get really unwell, then there are sources of emergency care, of which general practice is generally not a source of emergency care anyway. Would you put it all back in Pandora's box and go back to the way it was? Do you think, is it better? Is it actually better having these systems?
I think it's different. Yeah.
Okay.
Drop out answer. Better, again, is the wrong word. I think it's just different. And we need to recognize that healthcare is changing. And we need to recognize that the way that we use healthcare is also changing as well. I would not want to lose some of the stuff that we've learned over the past year in terms of how we deal with things. So, like I said, you know, being able to send information, that using the technology resources to help us do our job, absolutely don't want to lose that. Would I want an opportunity for a patient to contact me electronically with something that, you know, that they can do at their own time and space, they could do potentially at 10 o'clock in the evening? Only if it was non-urgent. So I think urgent requests shouldn't really be done through an online consultation portal. I think, you know, that needs the opportunity to provide some information, but that will often need to be upgraded to a telephone or a face-to-face fairly rapidly. And I think that can lead to potentially different types of delays. I think for routine health issues, you know, chronic management, disease management, those kind of things, actually a lot of that can work really well potentially through an online consultation format, because it's just relaying information back and forth to understand how certain things have changed. So the follow-up I think can work really well through an online consultation portal, but the fresh off the bat, that's a bit different, that's more complex, so it's trying to understand how that works effectively for the patient as well as for the practice. And one thing you mentioned, which was about the comfort of the risk assessment, it's important to remember that clinicians, GPs, many of us have moved to a really uncomfortable place of having to do this in a very quick time frame. And we've not had the training to do that. We've not had the, you know, the experience in some cases to do that. And that makes it really unsettling. And if the clinician's anxiety about how to deal with things safely through these particular routes is there, that's already going to make the situation a lot more challenging. And it's going to therefore mean that it's probably not going to be successful for either part, you know. And yes, you can go off and go on courses and stuff, and if people want to, you're more than welcome to join ours. So I think Andy's popping it on the screen right now, isn't he, in terms of, so myself and Dr. Ed Pooley, people may have come across, we created a remote consulting challenge to help you deal with some of all this stuff, and which is free to access. You know, it's 5 days worth of stuff to help you, but you know, even that can help to understand some of the challenges. Until you've been doing it for a while and are comfortable doing it, then it becomes really still an unsettling thing for, I think, the clinicians to deal with. And if the clinician's anxious about it, as I said earlier, the patient's not going to find it a great experience. So, you know, we need to understand that part just as much as the provision of the tools to enable us to do it. Sorry, ranting again.
No,
we're
okay.
A lot of that today, aren't we?
Well, yeah, it's one of those topics that I think drives emotions quite high, I think, in general practice. Mm-hmm. We've had quite a lot of engagement with people on the chat as well today, mm-hmm. on this topic. People clearly frustrated, but maybe acknowledging that there's potential in some of these technologies.
I think there is more support as well for people to be aware of. So there's support from other groups. So some of our friends over at Redmore Health, I don't know if Andy, you wanted to share that, so that they're creating some support tools and programs and stuff to help different areas. So this relates to one of the areas, I think, down south that they're planning on doing shortly, you know, how to deal with increasing demand in online consultations. NHS England have resources that are coming through in terms of this. So some slight kind of headline news for you. There's a document coming out from the BMA and NHS England in the next week or so, an FAQ section on how to deal with online consultations, due in the next few days. So hopefully we will have more structured guidance for practices to understand how to deal with this a bit more effectively. It talks about things like, you know, can you switch off online consultations? The answer to that is yes, you can, but you need to understand the impact that's going to have. It's not going to fix the problem by switching it off. I don't think it will. And also that the CCGs absolutely need to be supportive of how practices are dealing with this. And that's the other thing to remember, that your CCGs are meant to be supporting you to deal with a lot of this workload. So if there are particular challenges that are coming up on a regular basis, you know, they need to be supportive of this. And this is where, you know, I think we need to talk about the future of what's coming or what should be coming. So any ideas, Andy?
So, well...
What would you think? What do you
what
think?
Do I think?
Future of online consultations.
So I think that the drivers are currently coming from the wrong places, in a way. So I think it's largely being driven at the moment by a sort of consumer healthcare culture approach, which I think. It's attractive for politicians to promote and pander to, and then blame other people when the implementation isn't quite what they or people might want. But there's some political expediency to it. And I think that's a problem. And I think online access and consultations is becoming a bit of a political tool. Yeah. I also think there's an efficiency red herring. That online consultations create, allow you to do more work with less or more work with the same. And I'm not sure that that's ever been demonstrated to be the case. I think we
suggest the exact opposite, that they don't save time. And they just,
and I think we don't
use them.
And I think we don't fully understand the effect on the workforce. So I actually think, you know, the future potentially might not be great going forwards. However, I think this is where physicians need to try and take control of the agenda a little bit more, which I think is a little bit part of what we're doing by not being, you know, absolutely evangelical about it and highlighting that there are problems, and yes, there's promise, but it needs to be done in the right way. So I think we need to understand what these technologies do and what they don't, that they don't create resources out of thin air, I think we need to reflect on where these things have worked well. It's been physician driven, and I think we just need to take more control and ownership of this space ourselves. And I think that's what people, you know, out there in the EGP learning community can do, because they're people with the interests and the skills. And I think people should get involved in their CCGs procurement, get involved in the local deployment of these technologies, and influence it in a way that will ultimately benefit patients and not give them what they think they want, but, you know, what the treatment that they need, really, which might sound a little bit paternalistic, but the politicians don't necessarily know how to implement this any better than we do. So I think that we need to take control. That perhaps that wasn't quite what you were looking for, Gandhi, but I think EGP learners need to step up.
I think it raises a valid point. So, you know, we talk about how access to healthcare professionals has to be through this particular route, has to be free, it has to be timely, it has to be, you know, easy access, all that kind of stuff. You look at that compared to accessing, for example, your MP, it's still the archaic system of I will only talk to you at a specific time in the specific week that you can be available to me. And yet we are being mandated that we have to do all these other things. So I love the analogy you had there in terms of the MPs and stuff, how the difference in terms of the, you know, the way that it works, but then also you've got the difference in trust in how that functions. I think in terms of the future, so I think we need more evidence to understand how online consultations are working. So you and I did a brief little search to find the actual evidence behind online consultations. And there's not really much, obviously, as you can imagine, particularly post-pandemic, because we're not really post-pandemic anyway, are we? But in terms of recent stuff, that there's not a great deal of information. And most of what we could find tends to say that it can help to do things differently. Doesn't necessarily mean that it is more timely or more effective in certain ways, but it just allows you to adapt what you've got. I think that's the challenge. We are a resource strapped system. You know, general practice was funded to provide 5 consultations at the most per year per patient. You know, that's how it's been always funded, you know, in terms of the evidence and the data for pre-pandemic and stuff. And yet, you know, there are many of our patients where we are having umpteen number of contacts. You know, so I think I saw one of our colleagues on the chat put this down. Let me see if I can find it. No, I can't. I'll probably have a look in a second. But something about 81 contacts in the past year, somebody had said that they had with a patient. You know, that is we're not funded to provide that level of care. You know, if general practice provides 90% of the NHS workload for less than 10% of the funding, you know, that needs to change. Here we are, Ali Hobbs, there we go. Thoughts on dealing with individuals who constantly contact us. So I dealt with a complaint from a lady who was claiming we didn't care, look after her. I counted back, she'd had 81 contacts in the past 12 months. 81. That's crazy, you know. That is what, 7 a month? And yet general practice is funded for 5 a year. That's something to consider.
Yeah, it's difficult. Obviously, it's an individual case, difficult to comment on, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, that's an impressive number of consultations per year. So Gandhi, one we'll have to wrap up in a minute, won't we? So can I ask you...
That's all right. I'm going to have, really quickly.
Oh, no, a few more points. But I was going to say I'm asking you this because I've got one. So one thing to make this space better going forward, just one wish.
So I'm going to give you 2.
Go on then.
So number one is better data. And I know that many people are looking at the whole standardization of GP appointments that's happening at the moment. So it's a task that's been put to practices, and we've done some data, some video guides and stuff on that. I think that will help. And particularly when the integration of that information for online consultation providers happens, which is supposed to happen later on this month, fingers crossed, that'll make practices' lives a lot easier in terms of understanding the actual demand. So when that happens, I think there'll be a lot more positive thing. For me, something that I would absolutely love to see happen, though, is secondary care using online consultations. Because I think a lot of our current workload is because, unfortunately, secondary care don't have the capacity, for whatever reason that may be, whether it's right or wrong, to deal with the backlog and various other parts in terms of their outpatient care. I'm not talking about acute care, that's a separate part, but outpatient care. And actually having direct secondary care online consultations would absolutely, from my perspective, and I'm completely being honest here, this is from my perspective as a GP, make patient care more effective, because it stops the GP being an interface for patients that are already under the care of a secondary care clinician, because I don't feel that is sensible, safe, or appropriate.
That's fantastic.
It's the experience of the patient as well. You know, if a patient's got a query about their secondary care aspects of things in terms of their investigations, their tests, when the next appointments are, why are they coming to the GP to ask that? Because we don't know. We don't have any of that detail or information. It should be direct to the secondary care team. But often patients at the moment are having to contact secretaries who aren't either available or not able to contact them back, or can't answer the question because it's a clinical one. And actually, why not create the same system that we have in general practice? Why not have the same principles embedded within the contracts that allow patients to get the information that they need and want from the person that is meant to be giving it to them, rather than having a massive diversion of go through general practice to deal with it, which then we can't even give them those answers. So, you know, just make it sensible.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good one. That's good. Yeah.
Worst if it ever happens, though. Whilst before Andy goes with his thing, I'm just going to say, if anybody does have any final questions, stick them down in the chat, because we'll go to the questions next if we've got any more. But go for it, Andy. You're going to say for your...
Well, no, it's not as good as yours. All I was going to say, I think just better systems that actually deal with queries in system where possible, and, you know, direct to self-care and don't require clinician time, and thus don't just end up as a magnet for inappropriate queries into general practice. So a little bit more of a continuation of the rant. I prefer your point. Yeah, secondary care need to step up a little bit as well. Good point.
And I know there's probably some secondary care clinicians that are now watching, listening to this, thinking, oh my gosh, these GPs are telling us what to do. Welcome to our world. You know, this is what has happened in general practice. You know, this happened to us. We online consultations has been added on to general practice to provide patient care. And, you know, absolutely, I think it can help. Why can't that happen for the whole of the healthcare system? Why is it only general practice that engages with this kind of method? Is that because we deliver 90% of the care? Okay. What about the remaining 10%?
Contacts. 90% yeah. of the contacts, isn't it? The secondary care physicians will definitely be on our case, unless we say that.
Okay. But then the 90%, the remaining 10% that gets 90% of the funding, if they're saying there isn't the available funds to do that, hello? What?
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, it's still not fair.
Yeah. But it's not also not equitable. It's not about fairness in terms of equity of service for the patients. It's not the same experience that they're getting. So that is not sensible either.
It might be an effectiveness of a system as well. But
yeah. Okay, we've labored on the point, and I appreciate that there's probably going to be some people that don't agree with us, which is fair enough. More than happy to take any comments or criticisms and stuff. So have we had any questions? So we did have one question from Ali, where's it gone? Let me bring it up if I can find it. This is a problem where you've got so many comments, it's hard to find the bits that are relevant now.
No, lots of interaction today.
Yeah, and we really enjoy it. Thank you, everyone. I know we've not shared a lot of the comments like we would normally aim to do. We have shared a few of them, but really have appreciated a lot of them.
Any tips for onboarding?
That's one I was looking at. So Ali mentioned any tips for onboarding. Absolutely. I would say that if you want easy ways of doing this, provide the information in a way that's easy for patients to consume. Personally, I would normally say video is a really good way because it's more engaging with people, but obviously that takes more skills for the practice to deliver. So if you've got somebody that knows how to do that, that's great. If not, do a podcast. Easiest way of doing it, because you are just literally talking into a microphone, you record it and you store it somewhere and just send that link to patients for various different things. So create a really short podcast episodes on how to get an appointment at the practice, how to request your prescriptions at the practice, how to, you know, do the various different things, how to request visits, how our appointment system works. A 5-minute episode of just briefly explaining succinctly how your appointment system works. Upload as a podcast. You can do it for free. We'll stick some links in to show you how to do that. It doesn't, you know, although me and Andy have been doing this for years. Yes, if you want absolute top quality, it takes a bit of work and effort. If you just want something that's free, easy and simple to do, to be honest, it can take about an hour. And that's a really nice way that you can then send, because you can send the link to the patients through, you know, Accurix, eConsult, MJOG, whatever systems you're using. And if you really had to deal with it, you know, if you work in a multicultural area, you can get somebody to then translate those things relatively cheaply and stuff. So then you've also got it available in other languages to tackle those.
Yeah, or let YouTube subtitle it for you.
Yeah, so if you're doing videos,
other languages
subtitle it for you as well. But I probably, because of the technology and stuff, yeah, I'd probably
say
it's
a little bit ropey. But
yeah, you know, even if it means paying a translator for an hour just to read out what you've done in English and in, you know, medical translator, if that saves you 30 appointments because of the patients that have better understanding of how they use your healthcare system, surely that's worth it in the long run. Yes, it's the opportunity cost and stuff, but it will absolutely save you time and stress and hopefully less complaints as well, because then it's a resource you can send to patients when they've had a problem with a prescription. Oh, we understand you've had a problem getting your prescription. Here's some information as to how to do it that they can then consume in their own time. And also you can document that you sent it to them as well. You know, onboarding, we need to do it so much better. Thanks for that, Ali. I don't think we've got any more questions from what I can see.
One last question, although the community have answered it for us, I think. Joltuk, 1212, quite a nice question. Just about how many.
Yeah.
There you go.
So what are your feelings on the many attempts to contact are reasonable for low, non-urgent requests or responding with patients asking for callback later so they can finish their Zoom calls? So me and Ed covered this in terms of how you engage patients with remote consultations in particular. I think it's A, being clear and have a practice policy in what you would do. So, for example, when it comes to routine healthcare, we say to patients, you know, this is the time of your appointment. You need to be available at that time. If you miss it, you miss it, because it's no different to when they came down to a practice appointment. And, you know, urgent care is different. I'm going to stress this. You can't have the same rules for urgent care as you can for routine care. You can have similar, but I don't think you can have the same, because what you don't want is obviously to say to a patient, you know, for urgent care, we're only going to try you once, and then they call back and then, well, we're only going to try you once. You can't do that for urgent care because it's not safe. You know, particularly kids is one of the things I would always stress, that, you know, you be cautious, use common sense, basically. But, you know, if people are not available, with all due respect, they booked a planned consultation to have something at this time. If they're not either able to identify the times that they're available and they match up with when the practice staff are available, then they just need to accept the fact that for non-urgent stuff, they're going to have to wait. You know, I had a patient contact that wanted one of my colleagues to contact them back on a Wednesday, but my colleague has never worked on a Wednesday. So the simple answer is we can't arrange that. And then the patient was really upset that that couldn't happen because that's when they wanted the contact, but we can arrange it for another time. We just can't do it on a Wednesday because that person does not work on a Wednesday. That's not something that can be changed. You know, it's not something we're going to change because, yeah. But for some reason, that concept seemed really difficult for the patient to accept. And we didn't understand why. And we offered various other solutions, but no. And so they put a complaint in that the person wasn't available on a Wednesday, despite the fact they never worked on a Wednesday.
Can't satisfy everyone.
Exactly. But I think it's being clear, being direct about what you can and can't offer. I think with patients for online consultations, you know, having a system that says when are they either not available or when are they available. I would actually prefer to say when are they not available is a better way of doing it, because then you can contact them if it, you know, at other times that suits the clinician, rather than having a specific, this is the only time I'm available, because actually that's not often the case. It may be, don't get me wrong, but you know, we probably need a bigger window for understanding how we can help and support the patients, rather than just, you know, or a 10-minute time frame in the 24-hour day, you know.
Hear, hear. Cool. So any closing thoughts, Gandhi?
I think it's a complex area. I think there's absolutely things we're going to see change and develop over the coming years, and I think, unfortunately, for many people's perspective, online consultations is something that's going to be here to stay. But I think clinicians need to take a better handhold of how they want to deal with it. I think important that practices are doing it. It is in our contract. So emphasizing that point, you know, you need to be offering online consultations. And this has ended up being a lot longer than we planned it to be.
Really interesting topic, though. And right. It's an exciting future, but yeah, I think clinicians need to take control. There's so much work done, you know, about what happens within the consultation, you know, consultation models, consultation theory. It's all quite, you know, evidence-based, very considered. But then the system of managing and accessing that, it just seems completely consumer culture, politically driven. And I think it's not right. I think we need to move into that space and you know, inhabit that space too. Anyway,
agreed.
There we go.
Cool. EGP, if you have found this useful, and we hope you have, fair enough, we're hitting almost an hour and 20, which I think is our longest episode we've ever done, Andy. Yeah, we need to cut it off. But definitely leave us a comment, leave us a like, absolutely share this with your colleagues if you feel this has been useful and effective, you know, for other people to see and hear. We would love it if you could do that. Yeah, any comments and stuff, we'll happily take them on board. And as always, EGP, we're here to help save you and your patients.